I'm Gary, I'm an alcoholic. My sobriety date is December 3rd, 1964. And well, that tells you I'm old, amongst other things. Okay, quite briefly, I'll be talking about all my drinking experiences. All took place in Wyoming and Colorado. Just briefly, I was raised outside of Cheyenne, Wyoming, on what they called an experimental farm. And I was not the experiment, but that was just kind of part. I was raised out in the country, and it was kind of the thing that I didn't get a whole lot of experience. But what I remember the most about those days was as a kid going to school and that sort of thing, the worst you could do is ask me to go up to the blackboard and recite something in front of those kids, and I couldn't do it. And so I was, you know, I was just kind of scared about everything I touched. At any rate, managed to finish school, barely. Spent a short time in the Army with one small court-martial. And my drinking started, really, seriously, when a few of us in high school had just kind of got a hold of some beer and things. Let me back up about that a little bit. I was raised by my dad, who was a chemist with a master's degree, and it was that way. And then there was my mother, who was, she was primarily a good secretary. I didn't know that. I was going through some old papers recently, and she had earned and won over her years when she was working. And that was for the United States Air Force with that. So it kind of went fine. At any rate, I haven't talked for a while. You can tell that. I'm not getting going. As a kid in school, it was really difficult for me. What I can tell you about it is the kids I looked up to were probably the ones that were going to get me into the most trouble. And I can remember when I was in the seventh and eighth grade and that sort of thing, the junior high school I was going through, there was they called it a deli across the street. It was just a place you could go get a sandwich and something like that. But all the kids that were not considered the top kids there would be across the street over there and smoking cigarettes. And so naturally, that's where I thought I ought to go. And that just kind of started thing. I was easily taken into things that I shouldn't have been doing. That's kind of part of things I was doing. The most difficult things for me to do were talk to girls. They just scared the hell out of me. So growing up and going through school, and then finally, I did a little better with it, but I barely got through it. I remember, I'm going to flash forward a little bit. Every time I could get a hold of something to drink, from the time I could drive at 15 or 16, I did as part of it. And I even to the point where some of my friends in high school were kind of didn't want to go out with me because that's all I wanted to do. If we're going to a movie, I wanted to drink. Kind of the way it was. I managed to graduate from high school by the skin of my teeth. And a few months later, I ended up in the U.S. Army, where I was for... I've lost track. Back up a little bit. One day in high school, I was with a buddy of mine, and we'd gone to a basketball game. After the basketball game, and a bunch of the kids would go out to this wonderful city park Cheyenne has. And I was standing there with the buddy, and I was looking across the park there where other people were. And I asked my friend John, I said, who's that cute little redhead over there? And he says, oh, that's Julie Bailey. Come on over. I'll introduce you to her. And so I went over there and he introduced me to her. And a little brief acquaintance. And there she had been taken to the park by another fellow. And went over there and introduced her. And so she came home for me. That may tell you a little something about Julie, but that wasn't it. And I took her home that night. And I told her I'd call her the next morning. And I did, which kind of surprised both of us. But that was part of things to come with that. I managed to finish high school. I managed to go 6 months in the Army and a court martial, not a bad one, but nothing like that. But it delayed me getting home. But Julie and I dated quite a while then from that. So the day I got home from the Army, I called the high school and I told him I was Julie's dad. And we had an accident in the family and it's going to be coming by the north door of the school to pick her up. And so she was waiting out at the north door. And when I came by, she got in the car with me. And that was just another start of the things we did and they worked out. Two quick experiences and I'll move on. In high school, the state basketball tournament would be held in Laramie. That's 60 miles over a mountain from Cheyenne. And the state basketball tournament was there. And kids really liked to go there because that's when we could go there and party and be unchaperoned for the most part. And so two other fellows and I drove over there together. And a little while later, one of the guys who knew two girls, they decided to come with us. And we decided we want to get a hold of some booze. And I hadn't bought that before, but I found a guy on the street and all that and gave him a little extra money. And he went in and bought us a quart of four reels of whiskey. And so I was watching the old hands out at that experimental farm I grew up at. And watch them when they would take a drink. But so anyway, we popped that bottle of whiskey, you know, you wipe the top off and would pass it around. And the first time I did that, I passed it around to the next person and it kind of went fine. The second one I came around, I tipped it up and they had to take it away from me. And I was becoming more and more of a problem. I was really afraid of girls and that sort of thing. But I made a very clumsy grab at one of those girls sitting down there, and she slapped me around real good. And a little later, they decided they needed to get me sobered up. So we went down to the truck stop, and they're going to fill me full of coffee. Think that'd do, but all that did was wake me up. And things just really got kind of crazy. We were going out the door, and I can't tell you exactly how it happened. All I know is I took a swing at a cowboy and it really irritated him. And so he and they came out, he beat me up pretty good, then it was fine. And they finally decided they'd had enough of me and took me somewhere and put me to bed. And I can't tell you where it was or anything. I can tell you that next morning I felt terrible. I really felt terrible, but you know what? I couldn't wait to go do that all again. That was the greatest thing I'd ever had and ever known about. And so that was kind of what set my tone for that. And it started. So I managed to finish high school by the skin of my teeth. Went into the Army for 6 months and came back and that was a part of it. Julie and I pretty much stayed together that whole time. Didn't live together, I don't understand that. Needless to say, wasn't too long out of that. I was 19 and she was 18 and we got married and started having kids very quickly. And my drinking was getting worse and I was getting more trouble. My father-in-law had to get me out of jail one night and and did, but you know, he looked at me coming out of the jail, and he says, "You don't look good." And that's about all I remember out of that. But sometime later, my drinking continued, and I was no longer living at home. And I guess I was just looking for something. I've been drinking all that time anyway I could, writing bad checks to pay for my drinks. And back then, you could walk into a bar and they'd have what they called counter checks sitting on top of the bar. And you, so you go in the bar and say, "Give me a check." And they'd say, "Which bank?" Well, it didn't matter. I didn't have an account in any of them. And so I'd write a bad check. And then come Friday, when I got a payday, I'd run around to those watering holes and buy my bad checks back. And this one night, I ran out of money to buy checks back, and that, so I'd had to go write another bad check to keep my thing going, so I'd have sources. I was sitting at this one little bar. In fact, my father-in-law owned a piece of that, and I decided I wanted to talk to Julie, so I called her, and I was hoping to get back in the house, and she answered the phone, but what I said was I wanted to see the girls, our kids. And she said, "So come on by." And I thought, what you think at that point is now I'm back in the big house and the big bed and all that. So, but when I got to the house, her dad was there. And that changed the whole focus of the evening. And the conversations went, "Well, what are we going to do about you, Gary?" And at that point, all we really knew to do about this, in Cheyenne in 1964, was their Wyoming State Hospital is out the other corner of the state. Geographically, Wyoming is 400 miles square to a side. So it was a 400-mile ride on over to Evanston. Julie had an uncle that would go there often, had to take 2 or 3 trips over there and to get dried out. Matter of fact, he died in the pickup truck when they're taking him out for the last one. He didn't make it that time. But her dad and she came up with, maybe I ought to go up there. And I said, "Okay, I'll go." And I told her dad that, "And I'll go if you'll take me." And he said, "Well, I ain't taking you, but I'll put you on the bus." And so that's what happened. He put me on the bus, before I forget it. Years after I was several years sober and all that, we were over having Thanksgiving dinner with Julie's parents. And Julie's dad said to me, "Garrett, do you remember the night you went to the nut house?" And I said, "Yeah, why?" And he says, "You need to understand, I didn't care which damn bus you got on. I just wanted you out of here, out of Cheyenne." We both got on us then. But I found my way. I got on a bus. It took about a whole pint of whiskey to get me there. And I got off the bus, and I could see this hospital over not far ways when a cop asked me if I was going there. And I said, "Yeah, I guess so." He said, "Hell, I'll give you a ride." Now, that wasn't the first time I got a ride from a policeman, but they took me up there, and I walked in the door, and they asked me if I had come in to participate in the alcoholic rehabilitating program. I really didn't know what that meant, but I said, "Yeah, I guess so." I was, like I said, a month before my 25th birthday, didn't know anything. I'd been worried more about drinking than eating. So I was weighing about maybe 130 pounds, 6'2" tall, that skinny. And they took me in there and put me in a little square room with a door on it that had a window about like that. And that was the start of things. And that's what I came in. And they had some things to help me go through the withdrawal. And I came out, I guess, okay. And then they put me up with the alcoholic ward. And my guess is there were maybe 25 men in there, the men's side of it. And I was by far the youngest. But nobody seemed to worry about that except me. With that. So I was there for 16 weeks, and that was a normal stay. I didn't have to spend one hour extra in a nut house, but that was probably a good thing. And I, AA would come in there, and the few local people in that little town that would bring AA meetings into it. And two things went on there. I remember I was standing looking out the window at the cars pulling into the parking lot to come to the AA meeting. And I said, those don't even look like alcoholic cars to me. Because, you know, you were looking at cars that had one-piece windshields and all four fenders and chrome strips along the side of the doors and all that. They didn't like anything, any of the cars I drove. But anyway, they came in, and so my first AA meetings was the three or four people that would bring the meeting in there would share their story, and that, I guess. But two or three of them, part of sharing our story, they were talking about God, and that made me really squirrely, you know. That wasn't a normal conversation in my house as a kid growing up. And so this idea of a God or any God, it really had me uncomfortable. I didn't fight it, but it wasn't a part of my life at that point. So I'd go into those meetings and I'd listen to those people, and they would talk about God, but they were staying. It must have stuck with me somehow, because they were staying sober and going out of the way to drive in. You're coming up a good-sized canyon up out of Utah to come to Evanston, safe in Salt Lake or Provo. And so it's kind of a big deal looking back on it. But go to the AA meeting. They really didn't have a choice. They told us that if those of us on the alcoholic ward didn't go to the AA meetings, we had to change wards, and I had seen some of those people on the other wards, and that was not not a pretty sight. So we went to the AA meeting. So that's how I was attracted to AA. It kept me going somewhere I didn't want to go. Part of the thing going for me. Some things happened during there that was kind of crazy. I was by far the youngest member there, and it was kind of not a big deal. We had a canteen down in the basement where you go down and drink coffee, and this down there. And I'm down there with I think three or four other alcoholics. Most of those were older men than I. And I remember one of them had a ranch he wanted to try and go back near Fort Bridger, Wyoming, that's what he was hoping to do when he got out. Another one just wanted to get his family back when he got out. I don't remember. Oh, one of them worked out in the oil patch. He wanted to go back and make that big money. And so it's kind of sitting there going. And all of a sudden, they all start talking, and they're looking at me like it was my turn to say something. And all I could tell them, well, I have no idea what I'm going to do when I get out of here, but I do know I never want to take another drink. I share that because I had never had that thought before that instant. I really hadn't. Just my mouth moving. I thought, wow. And apparently that was true. And so what I learned in there, the pretty much what was alcoholism, and that kind of it, and I enjoy. Oh, they made it real clear to me that they help a lot of alcoholics in that thing. He says the ones we have the most trouble with getting sober are the very old and the very young. And so when they told me that, I don't think they had a whole lot of hope for me. I can't tell you that I had any hope with it. And time ago for me to go home, I got on a Greyhound bus, and it was pretty much of an overtime trip with that bus, and it stopped in Cheyenne about 2 a.m. And so I figured, and Julia was staying over to Paris' house with kids. And 2 a.m, back then, there wasn't much going on in Cheyenne. So I figured I'll just walk home. And I started walking out the door, and there was a detective sitting there. I can tell you his name was Lloyd Galleon. And he came up to Bailey's house. I see I've had I got some internet wandering around. Nothing I can do about it. I need to get a new router in here. Can you hear me now? Okay, sorry. And so anyway, I get in the car with him, we're going down there. And he's, Gary, you know, there are just some people that really shouldn't drink. I said, so you know where I've been? He said, Gary, I know where you've been and what you've been doing since you were 16 years old. I'd like to tell about Lloyd, because I think most of us have somebody out there. There are some we looked up to who seemed to love us, and every once in a while they show up with the precise thing I needed to hear. I think it's a God thing, but Lloyd Cases was one part of that. The next morning, I saw our youngest daughter, and she was standing in her crib, and we were sleeping in the same room. She's rattling the bars in the crib, and it's kind of part of it. But later on in the day, the doorbell rang. Julie's dad opened the door, and he hollered. He said, Gary, he says, there's a guy here who wants to talk to you. And so I went up there, and he introduced me. His name was Jim. And he says, what he said to me, he said, Gary, he says, you're not doing anything now, are you? And I said, no, why? He says, because I'm going to come by and get you and take you to an AA meeting. And so it was kind of like, he said, well, dang, okay. And so that's where I went. So we went to the old AA meeting, and he said, we're going to stop by the Laramie County Jail and pick up a guy that needs to go to an AA meeting. And largely because nobody knew what to do. 1964, this guy they're bringing in was primarily a heroin addict, but there wasn't any, you know, damn little knowledge about that back in the 60s and things. So we went into the county jail, the sheriff's office, and you can see the stairs that go right up to the holding pen up there. And this guy was standing, it was sitting in there all that, and I told Jim that had picked me up, I said, you know, I don't get along with that guy. And the two of us really didn't have much use for each other anyway, but his name was Phil, and we got Phil out for that. And I took him to my first AA meeting on the street. Kind of what it worked out. From that point on, after Jim took me to that meeting, me getting to the meetings were pretty much up to me and Julie and that. That was the case back in there where most have been irritated when somebody had to bring their kids to an AA meeting and could just be a little problem keeping them quiet. And that was certainly the case. Embarrassed hell out of me, but didn't bother anybody else. So my first AA at that point was going to those meetings in Cheyenne. Quite a bit different. But just what we needed. had to, I got a free ride to college at the University of Wyoming. And so Julie and I and the kids moved over there and found the AA meeting in Laramie. And it was a small town then with that. And I got a 4-year college in business and accounting degree in effectively 3 years and a couple of weeks there. And I was going to AA meetings. I did, you only had, as I recall, 2 AA meetings a week. That was it. But we'd get to them. And they made me the coffee maker. And I'd go down to that. We met over an old drugstore on the second floor. And so they somehow got the coffee making duties for me to do. And I'd go down there and I'd make a pot of coffee. And I'd take some of my books to study while I was waiting for that to get done. And that old room and that old building looked right across the street on the window. You could look right out and see the Buffalo Bar across the street, and had one of those flashing lights to go on and on. And I'm sitting there looking at them and saying, Buffalo, Buffalo, Buffalo. But the B was out and it said Buffalo, and Buffalo. And I'd sit there and watch it. And for some crazy reason, I've never forgotten that. I mean, that was a long time ago. But I remember those nights sitting there, doing my studies and that. But I guess it's important for me to say, in case there's somebody enough new than AA. So I'm doing that stuff, doing all those things. I never had a day go by where I didn't have the hole in my belly with the wind blowing through it. I was so scared and up that tight that untreated alcoholism is part of the deal that does that. It was crazy. So I was getting to it with that. Finished school and ended up moving to Denver. That was the start of things to come. I knew I had to find an AA meeting. And we were staying down on the south side. And somehow I found out there was a meeting not too far from where I was. And it was in a basement of this old building. And it was open and people were using it. And I went down to this AA meeting, and it was run by a man and a woman, who, of course, back then I thought must have been about 150 years old, but they weren't with that. And then there was another younger fellow that came in here into that meeting. Well, those two ran the meeting. I don't remember any Joe or I ever seeing anything in there. But he and I teamed up and said, let's go get a cup of coffee. I want to talk about how we can rewrite the book Alcoholics Anonymous. And then we decided we were going to only rewrite the first portion of the fifth chapter. And then about a week went by, we thought that was a bad idea. Anyway, a lot of things happened in there, but he and I one day were over at his house, and he was married, and we were sitting there belly aching about, you know, whatever it is we belly ached about when we're new to the program and didn't feel good. His wife was sick of it, and she said, her words would get the hell out of here. She said, why don't you go downtown? I hear there's a young people's AA group downtown. And she gave us an idea where it was. And so my friend Joe quick said, yeah, Brown, let's go ahead and do that. The girls are going to be prettier anyway. And last I ever talked to him, he still said that's the reason we went down there. But we got there and I looked around the room, and here I was with a little over, well, close to 4 years of sobriety. I graduated within 3 years and a summer session from the University of Wyoming, and been sober most of them. We went in there, the young people's group. And they were talking a different language than I heard in AA. And I remember sitting there looking at them, and I figured out with my nearly 4 years sobriety, I had some authority over those guys. It didn't work out that way. They started talking about the 12 steps, and I didn't know a damn thing about it. Nothing. And they were kind of making it clear to me that I had a little problem with all of that. So a couple of things happened there. It worked out to be fine though, and I walked in there thinking I could tell them how the cow ate the cabbage. Came back out with my tail behind my leg. Anyway, from that group, the start of things to come, and of course we attended Denver at that point. I had plenty of AA meetings, a lot of them, biggest city around. But during that time, we had two things happen with that. Julie and I, as a family, managed to get along. Our apartment houses we lived in, and got our kids going to school and worked out. It was working kind of going pretty good. When those people in that young people group had a man come in, got out of prison, Canyon City, Colorado, and joined our group, and thought he had this idea that if we really wanted to stay sober, we're going to have to learn to sit down and take the 12 steps in order and do precisely what they said. At that point, I didn't know there's anything I really needed to do that seriously. But so we did, and we found a place to meet. And it was in one of the AA members' houses. And so we started going up there, and I really didn't know what to expect or anything else. And so we went in there, we start looking at it, and we went through the steps. I didn't know it at that time until I read it and heard a little discussion that I fully understood that I was an alcoholic. And I knew that I knew that's what it was. It wasn't, I didn't have, and I had accepted that. I felt like I had a good handle on the first step. I was powerless over alcohol. There it was. Anytime I was around it, it was going to do that to me. And so I got by with that, and somewhere moved on to going to other meetings at that time. And I got to tell you that I took the second step because it happened to me. We would go to lots of meetings and plenty of open speaker meetings and things like that. And I would be talking, they're listening to the speakers there, and they're, most of them talked about God. And even that, I was still kind of squirmy about that. It really was, but that's what they were doing. So then, you know, the power greater myself is God. I finally caught it. And that was a big part of me. So the second step happened to me, but when we were doing that meeting. And after we had done that, we were looking at the third step. And Lee, one of the guys there, had an idea. And he was trying to, didn't want us moving so fast on the steps, I don't think. But he said he had been talking to other people who hadn't written an inventory yet. And he asked them why, and many of them said because they hadn't taken the third step yet. And that was really the first time we saw that as a prerequisite. But he shared that with us. We needed to do that. And so we had an idea that as a group, as his idea, we ought to stand up, hold hands, and if we didn't know it, or if we didn't, read/pray the third step prayer, or if you knew it, get up there and do it, and hold hands to do it. Well, I think there was maybe 13 or 14 men in there. The girls had moved on. I don't know why. Stand up, hold hands, and pray the prayer. And if you didn't know it, you could keep your book open and read it. And so we did that. I walked out of the meeting after that, and something had changed, but I still had that horrible feeling in my belly. And I asked God to make it real. Somehow, something's got to change. And I asked God, just please make that real. And so I went home like that. The next night, Julie wanted to go to an Al-Anon meeting, and I wanted to attend an AA meeting. And the AA meeting was like from 7 to 8. And her I'm not seeing anything haywire here. Now it's telling my connection's unstable. Has it improved? Am I okay now? Thanks, Kevin.
Yeah.
So anyway, I got home that night. The next night, she wanted to go to the Al-Anon, and I wanted to go to an AA meeting, but mine was first. So I went up to the meeting and sat down, and I didn't really look real close to who I was sitting down. There was just a vacant spot right there. I can't tell you what was said in the AA meeting, but I realized during that time I was sitting next to a guy they called Big Frank McKibben. And he was big, and he was a lawyer and good with words, and words of his size and things could scare you really well. And I didn't realize that when I sat down. But the meeting was over. We said the Lord's Prayer. And for some reason, he and I sat down together. Right, everybody else going out the door. And I looked at him because I had just realized something. I looked it up and I says, Frank, you got to understand something. You don't scare me one damn bit anymore. And he laughed, a big laugh, and threw his arms at the door, and he hugged me. And that's when I thought I was going to die. But so anyway, I head home after that. And I felt so good. And it felt like my fanny wasn't even hitting the seat in the car. Like I was kind of floating. And so I got home, give Julie the keys to the car, go on. I go in and needed to tell our daughters. So I went into the youngest daughter. And she was asleep already. So I kissed her goodnight anyway. And I went upstairs, and the oldest girl was... We visited for a little bit. I kissed her goodnight. And went into the middle daughter's room. And she was laying there crying. Our middle daughter had ulcers. And she had been diagnosed with ulcers. And maybe I don't remember all about it. But she's laying there crying. And so I went downstairs and I got her a glass of milk. And that seemed to help a little bit. Where I had to I'd been working in a business that was owned by a street preacher and a very religious Catholic man. And they were talking about prayer, and the street preacher believed you could pray and some of them would get well from your prayers and praying for the sick and that, because he was doing it on the street. And so anyway, I didn't know what else to do. And so I said, Patty, would you like to pray about that? And she said she did. And so held one hand, I put my other hand on her tummy. And I said a prayer. I got no idea what I said. That's the first time I'd ever made a serious prayer that anybody could hear in my life. And I did it. When I opened my eyes, she was sound asleep. And so I went downstairs and sat down in my chair, and I still had this sense that I was floating, that I had in this room. Now, if you flash forward 3 or 4 months, I guess, maybe 5 or 6, I don't know how long it was, came in the house from work, and the kids were coming in about the same time, and Jilly had been cooking some Mexican food, a Mexican dinner, with a thing we still love and all that, and I don't know as many people in your part of the country has heard about green chili, but it's green because it's made mostly with peppers and no tomato sauce or beans. Anyway, we all love it. And the oldest girl said, well, what's Patty going to eat? She can't eat that. And Patty said, oh, I can too. My tummy hasn't hurt for a long time. You can do what you want with the story, but it's my story. And going with it, that worked out fine. And I don't remember, a couple of Thanksgivings ago or three, I was talking at a big gratitude meeting up on the north side of Indianapolis, this big church, the night before Thanksgiving. And I was speaking up there, and my two oldest girls had come up with us to get back because they hadn't heard me shoot off my mouth for a long time. And so I told that story. I just told you about her and that. And I said, as far as I know, she's not had any stomach problems since that. And I look over to where she is sitting over the other crowd. She said, that's right. That's right. It's all about God. And that's what it was. While got a freak back, got back up a little bit. When I was living in Laramie, going to school, a traveling salesman came through. If you live out in small towns like that, and a traveling salesman or somebody traveling through comes to your meeting, that's great because we don't have to listen to ourselves. That's the biggest treat you can have. And so the salesman came in here, and so we really enjoyed him being there. And he came up to me and he says, how old are you? And I says, I'm 26. Why? And he says, wow. He says, yeah, you got a good shot at making 50 years sobriety. Well, 1964, there was nobody that in members of AA that had 54 years sobriety. So that's not anything one was thinking about. It's just kind of crazy. And I didn't think about it at all until I had about 48 or 49 years. And then I was working a little harder to make sure I got 50. So it worked out. We took a job here in Indianapolis in 1977 and sold our house and came out here. I had a business that I gave to my partner with that. We didn't realize it, but he had a business out of Nashville, Tennessee. And I really didn't know what it was, but he knew that I've done a lot of selling and things. And so he hired me to go out there to do that. So that's when we moved to Indianapolis. And he had a recording studio down in Nashville where they recorded jingles and advertising things and that. And so effectively my job is here where it's working. Is calling on banks and savings and loans. That's a long time ago. Some of you got to remember. And retail businesses. That's what I started doing. Didn't know anything about any of that. And so, and going to AA meetings and that. So did that for a while. And I spent time in Nashville for a while, learning what I was doing. But that's what got us here. And so that was such a huge change coming to Indianapolis from what we knew in Wyoming and Colorado. It's a lot different. I was told if you move, stay there for a year because you're going to have the most pressure to leave before that year is up. If they can do it. And I don't know who told me that, because I think we both, Julie and I both wanted to turn out and go back to the Rockies where we'd lived and all that. A lot we talked about. Didn't do it. We did that year, and then the idea was out of our heads. This became home. What I was looking for when I got here, though, was Amanda sponsored me, but I couldn't find a man that had ever gone through the 12 steps in order. We decided town we lived on, I was attending a meeting, there was an Irish lady named Peggy there who had, I don't know, she had a fistful of girls she sponsored. She was taking them through the steps. And so I asked her, I said, are there any men out here that around there? She says, I don't know a damn one. And she suggested a guy up on the north side. I can ask her about that. And went up and I met him, and that he'd become a trustee at one time or another. But he didn't know much about the program, as you find it in the book Alcoholics Anonymous, with that. So it got kind of tricky. So I decided to do what we had done in Denver, where we ended up with a group of us that had 13, 14 men. When we said that, the 13, 14 men, when we said that Lord, that prayer together and all that, 13 men came out of that, and we had all either died sober, and 1, 2, 3. There's 4 of us still alive and participating in Alcoholics Anonymous. I think that's pretty good odds, don't you? I mean, I think that was awesome. So came out here, and so I don't remember just how I put the word out, but I ended up, a good friend of mine and I get it up, and we started taking men through the book in one of the guys' basements down there. We got that going. I think there's 4 others there, and we go through the big book and go through it step by step, just like it says with that. And 2 of those guys, when they left there, they were so fired up, they went out and irritated and about another 30, 40 guys in Indianapolis. And it kind of started. And so for the longest time there, I don't think it's quite so true now, but here in Indianapolis, you'd go to a meeting and a different meeting, and there'd be a speaker there, or maybe it's a discussion meeting, or going around the table. They'd talk about what had happened to them after they went through the 12 steps, like the book had asked them to, when they had somebody to coach them while they're going through it. It went on for a long time. And so now, if you go to a meeting, that sort of thing, it still goes on like that. And I didn't know we were going to do that. It so happened that there was a school teacher on the east side of Indianapolis that had been taking people through the 12 steps via the 12 and 12. I know I lost my connection. Can you hear me now?
You're out of time, too.
Okay, I'm out of time. So anyway, what we got now is sober a long time. I'm still active in Alcoholics Anonymous. I've had the good fortune to know a significant number of people around the country and been to participate in AA meetings, and I've never tried to count them because they go to my head, and my head's too damn big now. So. That's it. But Julie and I are still married, and we have 3 lovely daughters still, and the youngest one has 5 years of sobriety, which works out because she drank up until she was 49, 50 years old, and that, so she you know, lucky to make it, as I see it, and 2 other girls. We had 5 grandkids, and a year and a half ago, we lost one of them to alcoholism and diabetes. If you have both of those, you ain't gonna last long. But he didn't do that. So I think the most important thing in my life, I think, never really got away for being a viable member. I've managed the central office for a few years. I've done many things without the Indianapolis Intergroup is a pretty active one and does a lot of things. And so AA was just been a part of my life, and I can't imagine it would have ever been anything else had we not been. How maybe it goes back to that old boy Jim who drugged me to my first AA meeting. What do you think? That's about all I got to say. Thanks.